This is September 28th, 2010, and I'll be redoing a Tay show that I gave a couple days ago that wasn't recorded properly. And since this is the only Tay show I'm giving until the Saturday of Chukai, that is Thanksgiving weekend, I thought, what the heck, I'll just redo it. I'm recording it in my office, and won't have the background responses from people, but better than nothing, I thought. We have Great Chukai this Thanksgiving weekend, and because of various scheduling problems, my next Tay show on the precepts. Usually I ramp up to the Chukai with at least a couple of Tay shows, but this time this is it, except for the review of the precepts that I will do on the day of Chukai. Chukai, for those of you who don't know, is the formal receiving of the precepts in a ceremony. So today I'm going to look at the second of the 10 cardinal precepts, resolve not to take what is not given, but to respect the things of others. And I'm going to look at it in a different way than I usually discuss it, which is to focus on how it relates to green, the whole green movement, ecology, and trying to reduce one's carbon footprint. And because ordinarily the way the second precept is understood is, well, not to take what is not given, and in the older texts they say not to steal. That's it, just not to steal. But that's quite a limited way of understanding it. A broader interpretation of it, which means a stricter interpretation of it, means not just not stealing, but not swindling people in any way, not exploiting one's tax payments, not cheating, not taking advantage of others in any way, certainly not even petty larceny. Some people might feel, well, you know, some giant corporation has so many assets that what the heck, I'm just going to somehow take a tiny fragment of that in whatever way I can. But this would be, strictly speaking, this would be a violation of the precept, not to take what is not given. When we broaden this to beyond individual behavior to something much bigger, we get into understanding the any kind of misapportioning of world resources to be a violation of this precept. Any kind of exploitation of people or animals or plants, exploiting, that is, exploiting the natural world for the short-term benefit to ourselves or some other fortunate minority. And this is what brings us into the topic of what we might call carbon virtue, of how far we are to take this as far as limiting our consumption of energy and limiting our production of greenhouse gases on an individual level. I'm talking now. Recently, I came across an article in Newsweek by the conservative columnist George Will, called The Earth Doesn't Care About What Is Done To or For It. And actually much of this article is him quoting a Robert Laughlin, who wrote an article in a periodical called The American Scholar. On the cover of that issue, it says, "The Earth Doesn't Care If You Drive a Hybrid." And then the title of Laughlin's article is, "What the Earth Knows." Laughlin, I see here, was the co-winner of the 1998 Nobel Prize in Physics. And this article could be construed as a way to wash one's hands of all of this and just, you know, go on wasting or plundering the world as one wishes. So I want to first take this perspective and look at the validity of it. He says, "What humans do to and ostensibly for the Earth does not matter in the long run, and the long run is what matters to the Earth." In other words, Laughlin says, we must think about the Earth's past in terms of geologic time. I'm just going to skip and read maybe every about half of the paragraphs in this article because we don't have time to read the whole thing. He says, "The world's total precipitation in a year is about 1 meter, the height of a golden retriever. About 200 meters, the height of the Hoover Dam, have fallen on Earth since the Industrial Revolution." And he sprinkles other statistics that show how little change there is in over great expanses of time in our Earth. Laughlin acknowledges that a lot of responsible people are worried about atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. He says, "This has the potential to modify the weather by raising average temperatures several degrees centigrade, and the governments have taken, quote, significant although ineffective steps to slow the warming." And then Will quotes Laughlin as saying, "On the scales of time relevant to itself, the Earth doesn't care about any of these governments or their legislation." Those of us who are familiar with George Will's political perspective would not be surprised that he would be so enamored of this scientist's views. George Will goes on, "Buy a hybrid, turn off your air conditioner, unplug your refrigerator, yank your phone charger from the wall socket. Such actions will leave the end result exactly the same." And then Will says, "Someday all the fossil fuels that used to be in the ground will be burned. After that, in about a millennium, the Earth will dissolve most of the resulting carbon dioxide into the oceans. The dissolving will leave the concentration in the atmosphere only slightly higher than today's. Then, over tens of millennia, or perhaps hundreds, the Earth will transfer the excess carbon dioxide into its rocks, eventually returning levels in the sea and air to what they were before humans arrived on the scene. This will take an eternity, as humans reckon, but a blink in geologic time." I'll continue reading here where Will interweaves Laughlin's quotes, the quotes from Laughlin with his own thing. I won't keep going back and forth between what Laughlin said and what Will said. Will says, "Laughlin believes that humans can do damage persisting for geologic time by diversity loss, extinctions that are, unlike carbon dioxide excesses, permanent. The Earth did not reverse the extinction of the dinosaurs. Today, extinctions result mostly from human population pressures, habitat destruction, pesticides, and so forth. But slowing man-made extinctions in a meaningful way would require drastically reducing the world's human population, which will not happen. And then Will comes up with a phrase he calls the pathology of climatology, in which he seems to be more or less poo-pooing the concern about what an individual or maybe even what what business can do to slow, much less arrest the fact of climate change. My take on this is that George Will originally, like other climate change deniers, would have nothing about how the Earth is actually, the climate is really changing in any significant way. And then when that was pretty much shot down, then he went on to say, well, if maybe it's changing, but humans don't have any significant role in it. And I think this is his third defense, is just to suggest that we might, as since we don't won't have any effect on these things anyway, what does it matter? It's a position of intellectual distancing. This is what some intellectuals will do. They take this position that look at the statistics. There's really, it's beyond our ability to change these things, and then one can just go about one's business. It's not to be confused with Buddhist detachment. Buddhist detachment is seeing this perspective, this vast perspective, as a balance to the other extreme of getting too anxious or worked up about every little way that one might affect the production of greenhouse gases and so forth. The problem with the article, as I see it anyway, is that it reflects a deficit of any sense of personal efficacy, that is, any sense of our being able to have the power to change anything. Oh, what does it matter? It's just way beyond our imagination what the Earth can do, and so it's a kind of helplessness that's suggested here. And I think that's uncalled for. That's really going too far. Just a little bit more in this article. Climate change over geologic time is, Laughlin says, something the Earth has done on its own without asking anyone's permission or explaining itself. And then at the end, Will says, 6 million years ago, the Mediterranean dried up. 90 million years ago, there were alligators in the Arctic. 300 million years ago, northern Europe was a desert and coal formed in Antarctica. One thing we know for sure, Laughlin says about these convulsions, is that people weren't involved. So that's one view of all this. I couldn't help but remember a passage from that's attributed to the Buddha that also sort of holds down this end of things. And the position that Will is outlining here is not without some validity. It's true. It does seem to be true that real change just takes eons and eons, and it's taking the long view. It's taking the big view, and that's not to be entirely rejected. The Buddha, in one of his talks, once said the following: "I consider the positions of kings and rulers as that of dust motes. I observe treasures of gold and gems as so many bricks and pebbles. I look upon the finest silken robes as tattered rags. I see myriad worlds of the universe as small seeds of fruit, and the greatest lake in India as a drop of oil on my foot. I perceive the teachings of the world to be the illusion of magicians. I discern the highest conception of emancipation as a golden brocade in a dream, and view the holy path of the illuminated ones as flowers appearing in one's eyes." In other words, don't get caught in the melodrama, as Ram Dass used to say in the 1960s and 70s. Okay, good advice. Don't get caught in the melodrama. The problem with resting in this view alone is that it denies the interdependence of all things. It suggests that there is me here, the individual, and then there's this vast earth and solar system and universe that is so much beyond anything that we can influence that what's the point? And yes, Buddhism recognizes that on the scale of things, each individual is very small in one sense, but that's only looking at it from one side. The other side is that each of us is the universe. Or as Zen Master Hakuin said, "I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth." This is the experience of awakening, is recognizing, recognizing one's identity with all things. This is what the Buddha meant when, according to the legend, when as a newborn baby he took seven steps, raised his hand up to the sky and pointed his other hand down to the earth and said, "Above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world honored one. I alone. Alone. All one. There is no other outside me. Therefore, what I do matters. It has an effect in the material world." And this is a wonderful way to move through one's life, is seeing oneself as the whole. Because it's true, one is. Goethe, this isn't just Buddhism. Goethe, the great German philosopher, poet, the writer, said he could have been answering George Will when he said, "I have come to the frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element. It is my personal approach that creates the climate. It is my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis is escalated or de-escalated. and a person is humanized or dehumanized. This is the kind of responsibility that results from seeing into the indivisibility of all existences, seeing through one's own experience. And this is what the Buddha also upheld when he said once, "I declare to you that in this very body, though only 6 feet in length, but conscious and endowed with mind, are the world and the origin of the world and the ceasing of the world, and likewise the way that leads to the ceasing thereof." So each one of us is it. Each one of us is this mind organism, world universe. And it matters what we do and the decisions we make, the consumer choices we make, and the habits we cultivate. The choices we make in terms of expending, using resources, or saving resources. But that too can be taken too far. Here is an article that appeared in the New York Times about a phenomenon that is getting a little play these days, about those who become carbon anorexic. Let me read some passages from this. It begins by talking about a Ms. Astick, a mother of four, who's very concerned about the environment. It says she has unplugged the family refrigerator, using it as an icebox during the warmer months by putting in frozen jugs of water as the coolant. In colder weather, she stores milk and butter outdoors. Her farmhouse in Knox, New York, has a homemade composting toilet and gets its heat from a wood stove. The average indoor winter temperature is 52 degrees. And then the article says, many people who can comfortably use the phrases carbon footprint, global warming, and energy offset in a sentence will toss a bottle or can into a blue recycling bin and call it a day. Those who are somewhat more committed may swap incandescent bulbs for compact fluorescents, rely on cloth shopping bags, and turn to mass transit. Actually, there's some good ideas I got from reading some of these specific examples of what more we can all do. Then there are people like Ms. Astick, a writer and a farmer, who is trying, with the aid of a specially designed calculator, to whittle her family's energy use to 10% of the national average. She and her husband, Eric Woods, a college professor, grow virtually all their own produce, raise chickens and turkeys, and spend only $1,000 a year in consumer goods, most of which they buy used. They air dry their clothes, and their four sons often sleep huddled together to pool body heat. And then skipping here, some people may view Ms. Astick and her family as role models, pioneers who will lead us to a cleaner earth. Others may see them as colorful eccentrics, people with admirable intentions who have arrived at a way of life close to zealotry. To others, they come across as energy anorexics, obsessing over personal carbon emissions to an unhealthy degree, the way crash dieters watch the bathroom scale. And then the article mentions another example, a J. Matsueda, who might also answer to the name energy anorexic or carborexic. He runs his car on waste oil from a Los Angeles restaurant. When he gives a gift, it is usually an organic cookbook or Al Gore's book, An Inconvenient Truth, or reusable bamboo flatware. And then the article quotes him, "That way, people don't have to accept plastic cutlery at takeout places." I think it's a great idea. I'm going to get me some of that reusable bamboo flatware. And then it goes on, "Mr. Matsueda lives the sort of life that the public relations firm Porter Novelli recently called dark green. The company conducted a poll of 12,000 people and they found that 7% earned the top designation, dark green." Well, this may have been what a third person mentioned here, David Chemitis, was going for. He's a cameraman in Los Angeles, and he's collecting all the waste he generates in a year in his basement and keeping a blog that describes his detritus. We might guess what Freud would think of this, how he would interpret it. And then another guy, Colin Beavan, a writer in New York City, is working on a book and a movie called No Impact Man, about the efforts that he and his wife, daughter, and dog are making to spend a year without harming the planet. In other words, no trash, no carbon emissions, no toxins in the water, no elevators, no subway, no products in packaging, no plastics, no air conditioning, no TV, no toilets, and so forth. And then they mention, again skipping here, when one half of a couple is less zealous than the other, it can be a strain. I will refrain from bringing forth any personal comments about that. To some mental health professionals, the compulsion to live green in the extreme can suggest a kind of disorder. And then it quotes a psychologist in New York, "If you can't have something in your house that isn't green or organic, if you can't eat at a relative's house because they don't serve organic food, if you're criticizing friends because they're not living up to your standards of green, that's a problem." This is a guy, a psychologist who specializes in anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorders. And then he says further, "The critical factor in determining whether something has reached the level of a disorder is if dysfunction is involved. Is it getting in the way of your ability to do a good job at work? Is it taking precedence over everything else in your relationships?" Well, I think most of us would agree that this article is highlighting the other extreme from the position that George Will is taking in his column. The position that Buddhism takes is a no position. Or you can cite, if any position at all, it's the position of the middle way. But the problem is that different people see the middle differently. So someone who is indifferent or who is ready to disregard all concerns about personal choices affecting climate change, such a person is going to see, of course, is going to see the middle way as differently than some of the people cited in this article, who are much stricter about it. The problem is one of attachment, and we can be attached to either of the extremes. We can be attached and obsessed with every little thing we're doing, and what effect it might have, and thinking that the whole world is counting on us to save the planet. That would be one extreme, and we can get attached to, as we said, to this kind of intellectual distancing about it all and ignoring the problem. At our annual meeting this past May, the issue of how the Zen Center spends its money and choices it makes about energy expenditures and resources, this became quite an animated discussion. It came up in the context of this final wing of Chapin Mill that we're constructing now, and whether the facts support geothermal energy as something that's worth the expense. And we found those of us before the annual meeting who really analyzed this particular Wayman found that it is a very, very complicated issue. There are so many different ways of looking at it, and always there's the issue of cost. How much the center should spend to have technology that's maybe just slightly greener. And as a result of that discussion at the annual meeting, some intrepid souls stepped forward and agreed to be on a kind of green energy committee that would examine all of this and how the center makes its choices and makes its policies. And they've been working all summer on this to come up with some policies that we can agree on. Much gratitude to those on that committee. One person, an out-of-town member, when he heard about how to minimize our carbon footprint at Chapin Mill, this is before we started the final wing, the construction of the final wing, he said, "Don't build it." There. Yeah. And if you want to carry that even further, maybe we were wrong to build Chapin Mill from that viewpoint. But here's the problem with that, is that it can be terribly materialistic point of view, that there are benefits that we can't measure on the scale of carbon footprints and energy and greenhouse gases. For example, for many years I flew to Sweden and to Germany, to Mexico, and we know that flying, we consume a lot of energy, a lot of gas, a lot of fuel. But personally, I feel that it was worthwhile. You know, we have thriving groups there in these other countries, and they're now independent with their own autonomous teachers. And who knows? Who can measure the ripples, the positive ripples and effects in terms of spreading the Dharma? I'm sure Amala Sensei, when she flies from New Zealand to here to teach, to lead sesshin or training programs here, I'm sure she has thought very carefully about the pros and cons of her coming here. So we can get excessively materialistic about this, and without recognizing the intangibles, the spiritual value that can come from burning more fuel. One of our members here at town for a while went through a period he was so concerned about reducing his carbon footprint that he decided to sit at home rather than come to sittings at the center. I think that's a phase that he went through. Who's to say whether what's the right thing to do? It's not my job to say what's right. I mean, it's my job as an individual to make my decisions, you know, such as traveling to Europe all those years to give sesshin. It's not my job to tell you what your decision should be and what your policy should be. Each one of us has to grapple with these issues and avoid the extremes of intellectual indifference on the one hand and obsessive concern on the other hand. But where that middle is, who's to say? I think those of us in spiritual practice may have a greater tendency than the average person to be overly concerned about our virtue. There was a British philosopher by the name of Broad, C.D. Broad, who said, "A healthy appetite for righteousness is an excellent thing, but to hunger and thirst for it is often merely a symptom of spiritual diabetes." The problem with the first perspective that was presented by George Will in his column is not acknowledging the whole picture. I meant to say this earlier that it's a little like voting. If we stopped on election day to think about the scale of numbers involved in elections, we could easily just shrug our shoulders and say, well, what's one vote? After all, it's millions and millions of votes. What is my one vote going to matter? Well, then what if everyone said that? Okay, we all know that this is the problem, is just ignoring that fact of, it's like cutting across the grass in your neighborhood. The stricter code of ethics is to not just to think, well, what does it matter? One person cutting across that lawn. Rather than that, the stricter code is to wonder, well, what if everyone did this? And then, yeah, the other extreme. I so often come back to the words of T.S. Eliot, who said, "Teach us to care and not to care." Well, that still leaves us with our choices and decisions to make, to know how to act in any situation. And for that we have sitting. We have Zazen. What we want to do is get underneath, so to speak, get underneath thoughts about this and that and numbers and the seeming pointlessness of our little actions and choices and to get under the other side too, the thoughts about how everything depends on every little consumer decision I make, and just lighten up a little bit, but not too much, to take this seriously, recognizing that we have a very alarming situation that is facing us with a melting of the ice caps and everything else we know about, recognizing it, not denying it, not fleeing into denial, but at the same time not going crazy over it, and allowing other people to make their choices, not judging others, not judging oneself, doing our level best, trying to keep it all in mind, keep our awareness of the effects of our actions. Every single thing we do has an effect, but without getting neurotic about it. And this is where we have to allow ourselves to settle into our Zazen and let thoughts settle, and then we just keep doing the best we can, knowing that we just keep getting more chances and to redeem ourselves for whichever extreme we may have fallen into. That's it. We'll now recite the four vows.